If you like what you're hearing on the Security Ledger podcast, consider subscribing to one of our newsletters like the Daily Ledger or the Weekly Ledger. You can learn more and sign up at securityledger.com/subscribe. Hello and welcome back to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode number 110, we've heard a lot about the risk of cyber attacks on the critical infrastructure used to generate and distribute electricity. But what would happen if someone figured out how to hack electricity demand? The Internet of Things just might make such an attack possible. But first, last week brought us news of yet another remotely exploitable vulnerability in Apache Struts 2. The popular open source framework that powers many modern web applications. This is the second major and remotely executable flaw in Struts 2 in as many years and has put the information security community on alert. A similar flaw in Struts discovered in 2017 was subsequently weaponized by cybercriminals and used to hack into high-profile organizations, including Equifax. Is this Apache Struts vulnerability as serious as the last one? The security community is of two minds about that. So to understand better what the latest Struts 2 vulnerability is and isn't, we invited Tim Mackey of Synopsys into the studio to talk about it. Tim is a technology evangelist in Synopsys Software Integrity Group. In this conversation, he and I talk about what's behind the latest vulnerability in Apache Struts and why patching this hole is really just the beginning of the work that application development shops need to do to harden their applications against this and future vulnerabilities.
So this is Tim Mackey. I am Senior Technology Evangelist with Synopsys. The first thing that I think everyone who might be worrying about this needs to be able to answer is, what version of Struts do you have and where did you get it from? So one of the biggest challenges that exists in the land of open source components is that there's no single distribution for everything. You could get it directly from the Apache Software Foundation's source code. They don't actually compile it into something that you can go and receive. That's not what the ASF does. Somebody had to do that compilation for you. And so as a result, you got it from somebody. Where did this code come from, and is there a patch available? And if there's no patch available, maybe you should be asking yourself whether or not that distribution channel is the right one for you. We at Black Duck have a report that we put out every year, and one of the alarming things that we see is that even when there's a lot of focus that's put onto new vulnerabilities like this, there's still an insanely long tail in terms of being able to update them. And so the first question should always be, do I have this and can I verify that I have this? Because you can't patch something you don't know you have. And then once you have that, there are a variety of tools that are available that will let you go and validate whether or not you are potentially vulnerable to this. But the first thing that I always come back to is, if it's your application, you need to be making certain that there is a set of approved URIs in this context. If you're getting it from third party in some fashion, that you need to make certain that they're adopting that paradigm as well. But there are a number of test suites that will highlight whether or not this vulnerability is in fact exploitable in your environment, given current information. And that's the last piece from my perspective. We have a vulnerability that gets disclosed. There's a lot of press that comes around with it. And over time, the noise and attention tends to go away. That doesn't mean that the malicious actors aren't out there going and actively looking for new ways to exploit something that was maybe disclosed several months ago, and that new exploit is even more powerful than what the initial proofs of concept were. So having some mechanism to gain access to exploit information flow in an organization would also be part of what I would consider a modern best practice for security response to an open source disclosure.
Maybe just talk a little bit about what Struts is. It's an application framework, but what does it do and why is it so commonly used?
So Apache Struts, or actually if you want to get really, really precise about Apache Struts 2, is a model view controller, which is a development paradigm that allows for abstraction of data for Java-based applications and web applications. So effectively what you're going to end up accomplishing is creating the moral equivalent of a modern application view on an older CGI paradigm.
How is this typically integrated within applications, and are there particular types of applications in which you would see Apache Struts 2 used?
You're going to see this in a lot of web-based applications. Fundamentally, what you're going to end up with is the ability to have a data set mirrored into an object construct that allows for the developers to have an abstracted away view on that that data set. And that framework gives a lot of value when you start talking about applications that are going to be functionally disconnected or decomposed, where we're not necessarily talking about a pure monolith anymore, but we're talking about the subset of data coming from multiple calls, multiple scenarios. So, for example, you might use this if your front-end development is going to expect a REST API and be able to have that REST API framework supported under the covers in what historically we might have called an N-tiered application, but fundamentally is now more of a distributed architecture.
And talk just a little bit, if you could, about this latest vulnerability. My understanding is that by default, Struts 2 should not be vulnerable to this. However, it might be the case that there are quite a few Struts deployments that are vulnerable to it.
So the core of the vulnerability, if you really want to get down into the semantics of it all, when someone goes and defines a namespace and a URL or URI that they're going to be accessing, what effectively ends up happening is under the covers, that URI is going to be resolved. And it's going to be resolved using whatever the URI specification might be. So if you are looking at, say, a TLS application, that's going to be something that would be hosted on a web service someplace and pass some parameters to it. The parsing of that to the URI within the context of the namespace allows for the application developer to say, hey, you know what, this is where my data is going to live, and this is how you're going to go and gain access to it. And that entire specification lives within the Struts framework. And that is where the root of the problem lies. Because there is effectively an execution or an evaluation of that URI in order to get the data set back, there is the potential to cause a URI action which is not necessarily expected by the developer. And that's the crux of the vulnerability. So the proof of concept code involved the researcher modifying the default configuration to allow certain actions to move forward, and then saying, well, why don't I, on my Linux-based system, specify a URI that does resolve to the calculator application? Put that in place, hit the web page that was supporting the test struts application, and lo and behold, up popped calculator. And so by extension, that is allowing someone to potentially execute code that was not intended to be executed on the system. And so the real challenge comes in, from my perspective, in how a framework actually is expected to operate. If I have an expectation that I'm going to be consuming or exposing these services, and I allow for an arbitrary manipulation of the input, then that's fundamentally on me, not necessarily on the framework itself. From my perspective, one of the first things that everyone can do with their applications is understand what is and is not an acceptable URI for that application in the first place, and ensure that if it's not acceptable out of the gate, it just never gets used, and it never gets passed into any framework. Forget about whether it's Struts or any other of the available frameworks out there, but that sanitization, that validation of that input data is handled right from the very start.
And how might a developer do that?
The easiest way is for whomever is deploying their application. So their application is going to be their custom code, and it's going to use Struts as the framework. In their application, they know what they're willing to accept. And so as a result of knowing what they can accept, they can provide, say, a simple dictionary or a map that allows for them to look up whether or not the URI that's being resolved is actually something that this system that they've put together is expecting to resolve in the first place. And so if I go and am faced with an application and I modify that URI on my machine or as a result of being able to hijack some aspect of code, I should not be in a position to cause any application to do work that it was not intended to do in the first place. And so that would be the first line of defense, is to just have a simple validation logic that says, you know what, these are the URIs that I expect to see. And if they're not in that list, then I'm just going to throw an error. Maybe it'll be a nice friendly error, or maybe it'll be one of these, oops, something went wrong, or maybe it'll just toss me back to the default web page. But nonetheless, that validation lives in my app. And that's me taking ownership of my application as opposed to expecting the framework to do some magic for me. And I think that that's really where part of the problem comes in, is that expectation that the framework is going to solve everything for me. It really should be a layered approach where the application is sanitizing its own data before passing it along to anyone else.
And why generally doesn't that happen as part of the application design process?
That's an excellent question. And it really comes down to two scenarios from my experience. Scenario number one is just the velocity of some of the applications that we have today are necessarily going to result in a more agile deployment model. People who are embracing various forms of agile paradigms have as a tenet that they can always roll back to something, or that they can very quickly resolve something by moving forward. And so that has a tendency to, I'm going to use a word that I don't necessarily think is fair to everyone, but it's going to illustrate the point, a certain level of sloppiness and what can be released. And so that's why standard input validation has been at the top of the OWASP hit list for so very long.
Sure.
One of the very first OWASP top 10 lists that I saw had make certain that you're sanitizing your data. And I've got the gray hairs to prove that I've been in this realm for quite some time. And you would think that if there was a magic bullet to it, it would have been solved ages ago, but it just hasn't. And the frameworks themselves can help out, but it's really a question of being able to have a clear understanding of what the test framework looks like as well. And if I look at the way that application security testing has kind of grown up over the last, let's call it 15 years or so, the static analysis that we had as kind of like the poster child, the linters of the world, the input validators of the world, they were all very basic about 15 years ago, and they've evolved forward, but they're still really looking at code semantics that are associated with proprietary code creation, so custom code that someone's creating. It's only in the last few years that we've gotten tools that are in a position to take and fuzz up inputs in such a way as to say, look, here's where I might have a problem. There's still the traditional fuzzing models are still very much predicated on an understanding of your code. I put that in air quotes, and an expectation that the frameworks and libraries have been tested by, quote, somebody else. And as we know from Douglas Adams, the somebody else problem, the SEP field, sometimes is a little bit stronger in certain areas. And that's where the interactive security testing tools that we now have at our disposal today can really, really shine. They can start to look for semantic variants. And that's, in essence, what happened with the researcher. She was using some new graph syntax to identify whether or not tainted data was present within a library, and used as the starting thesis. Developers have a certain level of habit in terms of the code that they create. And as a result, they're now in a position to go, in essence, repeat that same pattern of behavior, or in terms of the validation, repeat that pattern of behavior. And if there were a flurry of struts issues, as we saw in 2016, 2017, that were remote code execution, is there actually a pattern that wasn't fully identified with the core thesis? And so the researcher went through and found that, in fact, there was yet another new scenario part of testing this new interactive test framework that they're developing. So this is why it starts to become really important to understand that the testing methodologies are also evolving forward as the application development frameworks evolve forward as well.
You were talking about the research on this particular vulnerability. And does that imply that many of these vulnerabilities that have cropped up, both this one and the one in 2017, maybe originated with the same contributor or contributors to struts, that they might have common origin?
I wouldn't necessarily go quite that far. I would, however, say that as someone who's worked in multiple engineering organizations, a standard of quality, a standard of development, Basically, design and development guidelines exist for every single software code base. And it's entirely possible that code patterns aren't necessarily associated with the individual developer, but are also associated with whatever those development paradigms were, what the accepted best practice was at that point in time. And of course, those things do tend to evolve. And what was once considered a good way of solving a problem isn't necessarily the best way of solving the problem today, just because of new information, such as what we see from this researcher.
And if an attack were to come, I know that there's a proof of concept exploit out on GitHub. What might it look like from the target's point of view?
So from my perspective, I tend not to try and look at it as much that way. I definitely would say that you would want to understand what inputs are coming into the system. So standard web log analysis will help to know that someone's trying something. Whether they're succeeding is a whole different story. And that's where having an incident response team that can go and identify what quantifies or qualifies malicious attempts needs to be part of the overall operational thesis. And that's something that, for example, IBM has highlighted quite a bit this year.
To listen to you talk, it sounds like while patching Struts 2 might be fairly straightforward, again, as you said, assuming you have access to a patch. The real issue behind this is larger, dealing with input validation and kind of the way your product or application has been written. And that might be a bigger project that takes more time and investment, but most probably a worthy project, right?
Very much so. And that's where I would start to look at some of the newer tools on the block that all fall under the umbrella of interactive application security testing to go and say, okay, we've been doing this fuzzing for so long, and we've got all this dynamic testing, we've got all this pen testing, and that's working reasonably well, but there's another step that can be taken. And these new generation of tools are in a better position to help identify exactly where the issue, given a specific, let's call it bad data pattern that went in as input, ended up.
And thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Thank you, Paul, and you.
Tim Mackey is a technology evangelist in Synopsys Software Integrity Group. Up next, as smart homes and businesses take root, more and more power-hungry appliances are being connected to the internet, either directly or indirectly. Already, products like air conditioners and HVAC systems, water heaters, and kitchen appliances sport IP addresses and web-based interfaces that let their owners monitor and control them from a distance. But what if all those power-hungry devices could also be compromised and, like the hundreds of thousands of webcams and video recorders in the Mirai botnet, made to do the bidding of a malicious actor? Say, for example, to turn on all at once, or to turn off all at once. According to our next guest, one consequence might be a serious stress test for the electrical grid. Saleh Sultan is a researcher and graduate student at Princeton University, and he's the co-author of a new research paper, Black IoT, that studied the question of whether an IoT botnet of high wattage devices could be used to disrupt or destabilize power grids. In this conversation with the Security Ledger, Sultan talks about his research and his team's discovery that the threshold for causing disruption to the electrical grid is lower than many people assume. To start off, I asked Saleh to talk about how he came to look at the link between IoT insecurity and grid insecurity.
Saleh Sultan, postdoctoral associate researcher at Princeton Electrical Engineering Department. So in my PhD, I've been mainly focusing on power systems resilience against failures. So I've been mainly modeling failures in power systems. We wanted to know what are the causes of these failures, how they propagate in the system, and how we can come up with control algorithms in order for them to prevent causing any blackouts. So, you know, when I joined Princeton, we have been continuing on working on power system resilience and security, and I've been talking with Pratik.
To clarify, this is Pratik Mittal, who's in the Department of Electrical Engineering there at Princeton.
Yes. So he's an assistant professor at Department of Electrical Engineering, yes. He's an expert in computer security and system security, and we talked about this, the case of Mirai botnet, which is one of the largest botnets that we know today, about 600,000 bot stuff, and his main focus in, you know, system security. We discussed about this, and then I realized that, okay, what if all of these bots are these high voltage devices like ACs, these smart ACs, or, you know, these water heaters that recently become smart, or these electrical ovens, how they can affect the normal operation of the power grid. And then we realize, okay, these can be used to manipulate the demand, which is something that has not been really considered as the security of the power system. Because mainly right. most of the research is on the SCADA systems that control and monitors the power system.
Yes. So, yeah, generation and distribution really is where the emphasis has been, right?
Exactly. So the demand has been reliably predicted, you know, in the daily and hourly basis. It's based on the weather data, based on the historical data. So there's been no surprises there.
Right.
So we were thinking, you know, something like this can really change the equations here. Yeah. This is how we got into this research.
What was really interesting to me kind of reading your paper is to consider really what tight ranges the grid operates within. As you said, that, you know, the grid is really based on certain patterns of consumption that, while they do vary with the weather and time of day, they don't vary that much over time.
So the operation is mainly, you know, these AC power flows or alternative current, you know, use of operating the power flows in power grids can really, it helped really to have this supply equal to demand without accurate prediction of what is the demand in the, I don't know, in the watts accuracy. So as long as the prediction is close to the accurate number, then the with small fluctuation is the frequency, the supply can make the can make itself equal to the demand.
Right. And one of the things that you guys determined was that even with very small fluctuations in demand, depending on the structure, I guess the structure of the grid and its resiliency, that even very small increases on the demand side can be very destabilizing. Could you talk about kind of how you arrived at that conclusion?
Sure. So I think there are two types of consequences of these types of attack. One is on the frequency, that we mentioned that it requires a lot of smart devices or a lot of indifference between this predicted demand and what the demand would be after the attack. So those can be hard to achieve, but small changes in the demand can cause, you know, small changes in the power generation, which in turn change the power flows in the power grid network. These are usually, or they are mainly based on physics. So it's not like computer networks that system operator can reroute the power flows. The power flows are reroute them by the laws of physics instead of differential equations. So if you change the supply and demand in a way that has not been predicted, it may cause some line overloads in different part of the grid.
Mm-hmm.
And as the lines get overloaded, they usually are protected by these protection relays. And they get disconnected. And once you have a disconnection in single line, the power flows again rerouted in the network automatically based on physics that may cause, you know, several other line flows.
Right.
That it can initiate a cascading line failures that can eventually can cause a blackout in part of the system. And this is how you can get a large consequence by a small disturbance in the demand.
And by small, I mean, what are we really talking about here? I think people find it kind of hard to believe, oh, you know, you can switch on a few thousand air conditioners or HVAC units or water heaters and destabilize the electrical grid. But reading your paper, that's pretty close to the truth.
Yeah, sure. So I think they're right and wrong at the same time. I think in the paper, we show that the state of the grid is very important. So I think we did two simulations in two different snapshots of Polish grid, for example, that is publicly available data set. And we showed mm-hmm. that the same attack that is effective at the snapshot of 2008 during a summer peak is not effective, or it would not have been effective in summer 2004 because the lines were operating near their capacity in 2008. Whereas in 2004, it was a safe margin for the lines that could handle this increasing the supply and demand. So it really depends. So we show that these line failures can happen, but if they are predicted as part of the system operation, they can really be avoided. So the answer is yes and no. It depends. It depends. You know, what is the state of the grid? What are the characteristics of the grid? I think we consider several of them in the paper.
Yeah.
But they can happen potentially depending on what is the current state of the grid. Yeah.
So the town I live in has its own municipal electric department. So we own our own electric department. And I know on, you know, the hottest days of the summer, you will get kind of the reverse 911 message. It sort of says, hey, you know, if you can shut off air conditioners and so on during these hours, that would help us manage the demand on the network, kind of getting the community to do its part. But generally, I mean, do grid operators, either, you know, on the generation side or down in the distribution side, have a way to control consumption from where they sit? Or is that really up to individual consumers of the electricity, the end user?
Yeah, so there are two ways that they can control the demand. So one is the classical way. They can do load shedding. Somehow you as a consumer or part of the consumers may lose their power for a small period of time when it's needed in order to keep the stability of the system as a whole. In recent years, there has been also these new approach of demand response that basically these system operators give you these devices that can control your AC or water heater in the exchange for lower rates. So basically, you pay less, but your grid operator can control your demand, which is one way they could control. But it's not, I think the scale is not that large.
You point out for these types of attacks would be difficult for grid operators or even regulators to see because, of course, they're not attacking the actual electrical infrastructure. They are distributed across consumers, end users, and are manipulating demand and doing it in parallel or outside of the actual grid itself. What then is a way to address this risk comprehensively?
So I think we suggested two ways. And I think one way that we're currently working on is on the power system side. The power system currently are running or they are regulated such that they should operate even after losing one of the elements of the grid. So it can be a generator, it can be a line, it can be a transformer. In the day ahead system planning, they are operating their system such that if they lose a single generator, a single line, nothing could affect the normal operation of the grid. We were thinking similar standard or regulation can require the grid to operate after, for example, 1% increase in all the demands across the grid. So basically, we can make sure in advance that if such an attack happens, no lines will get overloaded by operating in the system such that 1% increase, the power flow is increasing and no lines get overloaded. So we can require this regulation. We have been working on developing these methods to find an efficient operating point for the generator such that these type of line failures are avoided.
So kind of building in overcapacity.
Exactly. Yes. Another way is on the IoT side. So basically, I think one of our goals was to saying that these insecure IoT devices have consequences beyond, you know, personal privacy and security, and they collectively can affect, you know, other infrastructure network. So some kind of minimal regulation is needed so that these have minimum security requirements. And in the high wattage devices, probably some kind of hardware switches can be incorporated so that based on the fluctuations in the frequency, these devices can get disconnected from the grid and cannot be used to further cause more failures in the system. So these are the two main approaches to protect the grid against these attacks in the future.
So I know because we were talking before, I mean, you and your colleagues consider this a very hypothetical risk at this point, just because there aren't that many smart water heaters, smart air conditioners. But you see this as a growing threat in the years ahead?
Yes. So I think if you look at the trend of number of these devices, you can probably see you have all of these devices that can control your temperature. so they can potentially change your power usage. There are all these smart ACs coming up. There are all these smart plugs, so you can basically connect everything to them. There are smart water heaters. So we're saying that would be a good time to really think about these threats before it's too late.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, these are typically sold as a way to conserve energy, right? So allow you to set a, in fact, I have one for my, you know, our DVR appliance, right? That sits underneath our TV so that it's not just running all night long when nobody's watching TV. It's what's interesting is people are often deploying these smart switches and so on for high wattage devices just because they know that those are big power consumers and they want to try and control that.
Yeah, I think that's the irony. But I think the main problem is that security has been ignored in IoT devices. And I think they wanted to have these devices as soon as possible in the market, as cheap as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Minimum regulation of, okay, minimum amount of security. Or most of these companies, at least they don't have strong security teams working on them. So probably more attention should be given to the security of these devices, yeah.
Salah, you and your colleagues presented this at the recent Usenix conference. That is certainly a very reputable security conference, highly technical. What was the response from the attendees there to your presentation?
I think they liked the work, and I think the security of IoT is one of the main concerns of people there as well. So they all know that these devices are not secure. I think security experts know much better that this is not a good approach of having IoT devices incorporated in our households, in the industry. So I think it's the main theme that these IoT devices, that these manufacturers really need to think about the security or take them more seriously. And I think another goal of our research was to really connect these two communities, these power systems and security together. I think because of the different set of knowledge, if you look at the people in power system, they always say that we need more people from security side to help us make the power system more secure. So we're thinking our work can kind of bridge this gap to just give a little background on power system and how they operate to these security experts. And hopefully more people can look at the security vulnerabilities of power systems, not in the demand side only, but, you know, on all other aspects. So I think the reception has been positive in general. In this work, we really didn't look any particular grid that is currently being used. Our work doesn't really say which grid at this current moment is vulnerable. The numbers there are only approximate numbers based on the publicly available data. We really didn't want to give numbers for any particular grid. And we believe that the current number of devices are practically not enough to cause these type of attacks on the grid. But in the future, they're definitely possible. So hopefully we can find good defenses against them before it's too late.
Saleh Sotan of Princeton University, thank you so much for coming in and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast. It was really great having you.
Thank you very much for having me. It was my pleasure.
Saleh Sotan is a postdoctoral associate researcher at Princeton's Department of Electrical Engineering.